First of all, no need to shut the doors. People can come in while Rabbi Artzin and I are having our dialogue, which is now a long tradition of Sinai Temple. This is the second year that we have done this. And this year we'll be working from a text that I will be reading to you, and then Rabbi Artzin and I will have a chance to talk about it. I'm going to read it from here, and then as chairs are being magically produced, we will then have a chance to sit and talk about the text. We didn't know what it is that we were going to discuss, and then a colleague of ours, well, that's high class help. Well, you can see him, Ariel Cohen, who is, yes, right, exactly.
We're listening.
So, a rabbi who is a friend of ours, a colleague, and a member of Sinai Temple, Jan Goldstein, sent out a letter to some friends of his, and both Rabbi Artzin and I received it, and we were in touch, and we said we should read the letter and talk about it. You'll see why after I read it to you. Dear family and friends, as you may or may not know, my oldest daughter, Yaffa, was recently diagnosed with cancer on her kidney. Fortunately, it was early and the doctor was convinced he could get it out. Her other kidney never grew after her birth, so this was her one good one we were dealing with. Yes, by the way, I did ask Rabbi Goldstein's permission to read the letter. Surgery was set for this past Friday at Virginia Mason Hospital in Seattle, where Yaffa lives. It fell on the one day I was set to oversee a major ceremony in Los Angeles to welcome the new head of school of the Heschel Day School, Larry Kligman. Just before she died, I promised Shirley Levine, the founding head of the school, and like a second mother to me, that I would represent her at that ceremony. And I wanted to keep the promise. Yaffa also felt that I should be there. So I stayed, but my heart all day was in Seattle. After the ceremony and services at Heschel, I drove through traffic Friday late afternoon and flew to Seattle. Once there, it seemed like it took forever to get a rental car and drive to the hospital. I promised Yaffa I would be there that day somehow, and I was going to keep the promise. When I arrived at the hospital, it was 10:45 p.m. I came to the first floor, and it was locked. I walked around the corner and came to a second door. A guard informed me it was impossible to get into the hospital, impossible is underlined, and I'd need to come back in the morning. Frustrated, I tried arguing. Rules were cited. It didn't work. I continued around the perimeter of the hospital, finding many locked doors. I came across two more checkpoints where, again, I was told visiting at that hour was impossible. My wife, Bonnie, always tells me that hearing a no is merely an invitation to go in search of a yes. I kept going. Finally, after nearly circumnavigating the three-block-wide facility, I reached one last service door. A young guard stood there eyeing me suspiciously. It was 11:30 p.m. My late mother, Zichrono Livracha, may her memory be for a blessing, always told me, when everything looks bleak, don't argue. Don't steamroll people. Connect with them. Tell them your story. So I did. I told the young guard what had transpired that day, that my daughter had been there for cancer surgery, that I fulfilled a precious commitment to a late mentor back in Los Angeles and raced up north to be with my child, that I'd given her the Hebrew name Yaffa because of the beauty she represents in my life, that I'd been a single dad for years and raised her to believe in herself and the power of family, that I hadn't missed the birth of her three children, and I made a promise to her to be with her that day post-surgery. Could he help a father keep his promise? With tears in his eyes, the young man said, I also have a little girl I love. Come with me. What followed was a bizarre journey through the bowels of the hospital. We bypassed elevators that required special codes to work, moved up numerous sets of stairs, and down through the basement. The guard led me to a service elevator. We traveled into the physician's parking lot and through another side door. At last, I was on the 16th floor of Virginia Mason Hospital. Lights were low and rooms darkened. The nurse in charge stopped us. The guard told her, this man has traveled for hours to get to his daughter. Can you help out? I must have looked a wreck at that moment. I gave her Yaffa's name. She took pity on me and with a gracious smile led me to my daughter's room. I hugged the guard, thanked the nurse, and entered. Looking exhausted, her husband looked up from his chair by her bed, smiled, and said quietly, she's been asking for you every few minutes. I looked at Yaffa, tubes everywhere from her torso to her arms, pushing oxygen into her nose. At that moment, from her med-fueled daze, Yaffa opened her eyes. She couldn't speak, but I could read her lips as she whispered, "Daddy." Taking care with the bandages and tangle of tubes, I managed to reach through it all and embrace her, holding her gently, kissing her forehead over and over and over. And then, as I had for so many years in our home, I placed my hands on her head and gave her my Shabbat blessing. May God bless you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. Tears streamed down my face. It was truly a blessing. You see, the surgery was a success. Her kidney was saved. She's cancer-free. Hug those you love. And whenever someone tells you that what you ask for is impossible, don't argue. Just tell them your story. Shana Tova, Jan. So since I'm too choked up to talk, you first.
Is this on?
Yeah.
You know, the first thing that has to be said is what a powerful story, obviously, and how deep a parent's love for a child, how deep our connections to each other. I think it's not a coincidence that the scripture that we read on both days has to do with parents and children. Even the Haftarah, even the prophetic readings that we read were about parents weeping for their children, parents providing for their children. There is a cascade of love that goes from one generation to the next, and it's that fragile and resilient thread that keeps humanity going and that keeps Judaism alive. We don't exist by virtue of worldly power, we exist because little 13-year-old voices face against all odds coming up here and chanting from an old language. And every time a 13-year-old does that, that's another thread that keeps the tradition going. So the power of that.
And I take from that also the power, as Jan says in his letter, and he's both a rabbi and also a novelist, so I think that he knows this well. The power of stories. I mean, if you were half as moved by hearing that story as I was when I read it, both the first time and then even more by reading it out loud, because there's something about reading out loud that doesn't allow you to skim over words or to suppress what you feel, then it's just remarkable. I don't think anything could touch people as deeply as a story. And that's part of what it is that the Jewish people have been doing again and again so successfully for the world, is to tell our story, and inside of our grand story, all the little stories that make up the history of our people. And one of the things that I wonder all the time, and I'm sure you do too, is how well we're teaching our children our story.
And I think it's easy to not be open to the power of our story, which is paradoxical because there are ways in which the world has taken over our story.
Right.
That story of God creating the world and choosing an enslaved people and bringing them to freedom has become the liberation tale of all humanity. And the only ones who don't seem to really appreciate its reverberations are the Jews. So partly it's reclaiming our own. But I wanna think about something else. As you were reading it, I knew that I would have to hold a microphone and speak here. So while you were reading it, what I did not allow myself to do was think about my children.
Right.
Because if I had thought about Shira while you were reading that story, you'd be doing a monologue.
Right.
And so I want us to also think about emotions so raw and so real that we know they're there even when we avoid them, right? And in this case, that love for a child that he had so sacrificed for, that there's a way in which we live with that even when we turn it off, right? Even when it's not able to come to the surface. And that deep story, I think also has its place in what you were saying about narrative and about the Jewish story, that there's a way in which that flows underneath even when we try to turn it off. It keeps coming back.
So I want to first make one comment on what you said and then also take this in a slightly different direction, because as you know, as Joseph Epstein said, Jews don't listen, they wait. So I was trying to listen to you, Rabbi, but I was also waiting. And one of the things that I listened to was about how our story has become the world story. Let me give you a beautiful example. I think everybody sitting here knows the word Gentile. What does Gentile mean? Not Jewish. We're 0.00001% of the world's population, and we have a word that everyone knows, Jews and non-Jews, for people who aren't us. Isn't that weird? Do you think there's a word for not being Albanian? It's so strange that there's actually a word. I have non-Jews who come up to me and say, look, I'm a Gentile. And I'm thinking, what you mean is, I'm part of 99.99999% of the world, but I had to identify myself to you like that. So it's true that our story really has become the story of the world. It's such a strange thing. But what I wanted to ask, and what I think is an important, especially each new year we should reevaluate this, is to the extent that we don't transmit the power of our story to our kids, in what way are we failing as a community, as leaders? What do you think we should be doing better? That's really a Rosh Hashanah theme that rabbis, because I mean, that was unbelievable. And I can't imagine anyone hearing something like that wouldn't be moved by it.
Are you done?
For the moment, but not for the day. No.
So part of what gives that story its Rosh Hashanah power is that when he finally, against all odds, gets into his daughter's room and by her bedside, what he's moved to do is Birkat Kohanim, right? The priestly benediction. So I have two Birkat Kohanim stories that I think play into that. Years ago, one of the things that makes mine the greatest Jewish job in the world is my job requires me to go to Jerusalem every year for 10 days. Don't I suffer? And one of the years that I was there, I actually had a free afternoon, so I went to the Israel Museum, and they had a display of things they had found from Ketef Chinom, which is a burial chamber from 800 BCE, the time of King Hezekiah. And, you know, mostly burial sites then as now are filled with tchotchkes that nobody cares about anymore. So there's lots of broken glass and there's lots of shattered mirrors and, you know, fine, very nice. But then there was one glass case that had a little piece of silver foil that the person buried in this tomb had wrapped around his neck. And scratched onto the silver foil were the words, Yivarechecha Hashem v'yishmerecha, the oldest fragment of Bible in the world. And I started to cry, because every Friday night, I bless my children with the words that this anonymous Jew from 3,000 years ago chose to take into eternity. And what people in the world have that kind of unbroken continuity where we're praying to the same God in the same language with the same liturgy that our ancestors 3,000, what a privilege that is. Second Yivarechecha story, Friday nights, we often bless the children with that blessing. And you know, our son Jacob, wonderful now 21-year-old man, who has just struggled his whole life to define himself by who he is and not by his autistic label. So Jacob took it upon himself. We always, you know, we get in a big family circle, we put hands on each other's, you know. Jacob decided he wasn't simply going to receive the blessing, he was going to give it. So he put one hand on my head and one hand on Ilana's head. And I felt this upwelling of blessing. So what we can teach our families, I think, is when you have powerful emotion, there are Jewish ways to express them. And in that way, it becomes not only your personal, ephemeral feeling, it becomes the expression of something timeless and transformative.
So how does, in particular, I want to ask, since I was involved in a slight bar mitzvah controversy earlier this year, not so long ago, I don't know if you, I mean, I'll give you the 20-second answer. There was a bar mitzvah video that went around that was extravagantly offensive of a party with a 13-year-old dancing with Las Vegas showgirls and his name in big gold letters coming down. And I wrote an angry article about it. And then his rabbi said, you know, you insulted the kid, not just the practice. So then I wrote a follow-up article that said, look, it was not intended to insult the kid, and I certainly apologize for that. It was just to insult the practice, and that I don't apologize for. But which I also thought, by the way, was not a bad thing. I was very, this sounds strange, but I was very happy to publicly apologize because I thought it's a very good model. If you do something wrong, especially if you're a rabbi, you should show people that there's no shame in apologizing, and there's every virtue in a colleague, especially, and the rabbi is a friend of mine and has been for many years, saying to you, you know what, you went too far, and saying, you know what, you're right. I shouldn't have written it this way, I should have written it that way, but still, it's a terrible video. Anyway, so, but how do you in a culture that has so much pressure and that so much is at stake in being public and being seen as successful and all of that, how do you transmit primarily those emotions and dampen the trivia at the crucial times in children's lives? Okay.
The challenge is that seen out of context, it's impossible to know meaning. So we don't know what that boy's bar mitzvah was like. We just saw the snippet of the dancing, right? Which I will confess I liked.
No, you didn't. You liked or you thought was appropriate?
Both.
You thought was appropriate? Dancing, to celebrate your bar mitzvah. Hold on, I gotta find this.
Can I just remind you, my office is in Bel Air.
To celebrate your bar mitzvah with Las Vegas showgirls doing suggestive dances and having your name come down in large gold letters behind, and that's the celebration of your bar mitzvah.
He came down
and
in a tube.
He came down
in a tube. Watch it.
In a tube, and then danced with them, and you really thought that was appropriate.
You thought, and he was a great dancer.
That wasn't my question. I wasn't questioning the skill. I was questioning the taste.
I liked it. Here's what I learned. Now, it's true. It's true that, you know, for 10 years, I was a congregational rabbi in Mission Viejo, which I referred to as 5 of the happiest years of my life. I didn't have as humble a congregation as you do, so my perspective might be somewhat different. We were in Mission Viejo, after all. But we did have a woman who was president of the synagogue and of relatively modest means, and she had a party for her kid that I knew she couldn't possibly afford. And she was a good enough friend that I could say, I need you to tell me why you're doing this. You're going into debt for a party that's extravagant, and I know that's not your life. So why are you doing this? And she said, I will never forget what she said. She said, Brad, the only time my family gets together is when someone dies. And we would like to spend our money to celebrate that someone's alive. And I that was really powerful for me.
I agree. It has nothing to do with showing up in front of Las Vegas showgirls at 13 years old.
But it's a good story. All right, so the main thing, though, is, here's what I will say, by way of compromise.
Okay.
If the party was the most important part of what that kid gets out of the bar mitzvah...
It's what got him on Anderson Cooper and Good Morning America.
Not everybody thinks that's what's most important.
That's my point.
I understand. So I think, though, we don't know what the morning was or what the Friday night dinner was or...
But you don't think that whatever the morning was, it's to some extent negated and contradicted by that being how you celebrate your adulthood in the Jewish tradition? Here's the party that celebrates my becoming responsible for the mitzvot. I am going to dance in front of 20 Las Vegas showgirls in, believe me, very skimpy outfits. I don't want to give you too much details. Everybody will go on YouTube as soon as you finish the... That's going to be how I will show the world, because it got put on YouTube, then he went on Good Morning America, then he went on Anderson Cooper. This is how I'm going to show the world that I will celebrate my becoming a Jewish adult. You think that was good?
Oh, this is my last year at Sinai Temple. But let me just say... let me just say that if you're thinking about this, when it comes to who you're going to invite to the bar mitzvah party... we do live in a very material culture. That is true. And there is a way in which Judaism also lends itself to that, because we don't have an attitude that being rich is somehow sinful, or that the world is a veil of, to snare innocent souls. We have a fairly robust, positive attitude towards enjoying the world. Granted, this takes it and puts it on steroids. But I guess the challenge is, how do you then loop that back in? How do you say to that kid, look, okay, even if the party was a bit over the top, I thought adorable, but over the top, how do you then say, what are the values in there that made that something we would do? And I guess if I were that kid's rabbi, and I wanted to loop it back in to Jewishness, because what we're not going to do is oppose people's material pressures flat out. We have to kind of use an Aikido move and redirect them back in. What I would do is I would say, what I got out of your party last night are the following lessons. The first is, your parents adore you over the moon. Right? And you need to carry that with you every moment of your life. You need to know that every moment of your life, your parents adored you so much that they put you on stage and they put your name in lights. And I want you to remember that every minute of your life. Two, I want you to remember that there will be temptations out there in the world, and you're going to be up on stage by yourself when those temptations hit. Right? And knowing what the right moves and the wrong moves are makes all the difference. Three, I would say, remember that when your parents chose to do this over-the-top celebration, they did it for your bar mitzvah. They didn't do it for your 12th birthday, and they didn't do it for your 14th birthday. They did it because, however far people drift from piety and religion, saying our kid is connected to Torah is, even for ostentatious Jews, still important. Now let's build on that. Let's build on, why is it so important that specifically your Torah birthday is the one where people go over the top? And I think there's a place to then segue that into, are there other ways we could celebrate that that might be more compatible with standard and traditional Jewish values?
And I would say that everybody sitting here knows they just heard a rabbi. In the best sense, I didn't mean that as a joke at all. I meant that very seriously. That's what a rabbi does. Thank you, Rabbi Artson, and thank you.